Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the British military presence in India in the 18th and 19th centuries, and what the Indian mutineers hoped to achieve in 1857 when they rose in rebellion.
Professor Jeremy Black, when we're talking about the British Army in India, really from the early 17th century until the middle of the 19th century, we're really talking about the East India Company Army or armies. Is that correct, or should we also talk about a British army distinct from this?
No, that's absolutely correct until the mid-18th century. From the mid-18th century onwards, there are regiments of the British Army as well as the forces of the East India Company, which, as you correctly say, are organised into three separate, as it were, armies after the so-called presidencies, the, as it were, the organisational bases of the East India Company in Calcutta, Madras and Bombay, to use the names of the times, of the time. I mean, obviously now Calcutta, Chennai and Mumbai. On top of that, though, it's worth bearing in mind, and this tends to be underplayed by, shall we say, some of the modern polemicists, that the East India Company also benefited from, but was also constrained by, the degree to which it was allied to local Indian rulers, some of them of great power, and they would deploy their own forces over which the East India Company had little or any control. And that both provided them with more, you know, bulk mass, which is always useful on the battlefield, and not least in the battlefields of South Asia, but also tended to deal with a particular weakness of the British Army, or shall we say the East India Army, Company Army, in South Asia, which is a weakness in cavalry. And it was particularly the case that these forces produced cavalry. So when one's talking about, as it were, native Indians fighting for the East India Company, one has to distinguish between whether they're being paid to act as soldiers in East India Company units, or whether they are allied forces, whether paid or not, of the East India Company.
I see. And when you talk of these three different presidencies, they each have their own army, which is almost entirely self-contained from each other, or is that a bit like talking of them as separate regiments within the same army?
Well, the scale of India was such that they were in effect geographically separate, and they could easily get involved in very separate conflicts. So the late 18th century, the Bengal presidency was under a lot of pressure from the Maharathas, whereas the Madras presidency was under pressure particularly from Mysore. And you could have different chronologies of conflict. Now, it was possible, indeed happened, to move troops from one to the other. Troops from Bengal marched across India in a pretty dramatic fashion at the end of the 1770s to help the Bombay presidency against the Maharathas. Troops would be sent from Bengal. Bengal had the most numerous forces, would be sent from Bengal south, usually by sea, to help Madras. And that gave the British a degree, or again, we've got to distinguish between what are we talking about, the British or the East India Company, gave them a degree of flexibility and a need, but possibility, to think at a strategic level that was not always the case when you're looking at their opponents.
And are we looking at forces in which all the privates, the sepoys, as they're called, are Indians and all the officers are British, or are they the are the British privates in serving in the ranks as well? And what about other Europeans, maybe brought in as effectively mercenaries? Is there a role for them?
Yes, there's definitely a role for them, and I think it's fair to say that there were, particularly at junior levels, some non-British officers, as well as non-European officers in this context. I think it's fair to say that the Sepoy units were composed of those we would call Indians today. People at the time, I mean, I think it's worth, we've got to be very careful here. There's been an enormous amount of misleading work published on the, both the history of India and more specifically on the military history of India. One work that presupposes an identity for India earlier than it occurred, and therefore downplays the significance of variations within what we would call India, and in particular senses of identity, geographical, ethnic, religious, and so on. And secondly, and this is again very, one needs to underline this, that what we call subsequently British India, and therefore often short circuit into the term India, is actually the background of three modern countries, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. There were separate colony structures for Burma and Ceylon, Myanmar and Sri Lanka. And there is a tendency, I think it's fair to say, by both historians who are Indians, and also a certain number, I have to say, of non-Indian historians who are historians of India, to underplay the extent to which you shouldn't assume, as it were, this Indian identity. Mm. And bluntly, to underplay also, in particular, the Muslim dimension and the dimension leading to modern Pakistan, and obviously, which is a separate issue, Bangladesh, which whose origins lay in East Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to ask you very shortly about the Indian Mutiny and whether it should be thought of as a war of independence, as it's now often referred to in India. But just before we get there, just so we stay vaguely chronologically minded, these East India Company armies in the 18th century, who are they? How often are they fighting? Is this a constant wars and mini wars and skirmishes? Is it largely a law and order operation? Are they actually fighting quite major campaigns? And what is the preponderance between fighting the French or other colonial interests as distinct from fighting more localized Indian interests?
Yes, that's an interesting question. First of all, can we take the last one first? I wouldn't distinguish those too closely in the sense that the French were in exactly the same position as the British. They were aligned with local rulers. And just as they were trying to use local rulers to their ends, I think it's fair to say the local rulers were trying to use them to their ends. So you ask the question how far we can distinguish this. If you're looking, for example, at the early 1780s, the principal opponent to the British in India, what we would call India, is the Muslim Sultanate of Mysore under first Hyder Ali and then Tipu Sultan, his son. They are allies of the French. So you've got to be very careful. Are the British fighting them to fight, as it were, a pro-French force? Or are they fighting them because, you know, as it were, we wish to choose, treat French intervention as a sort of an extraneous factor? I mean, I would actually put the emphasis on the first, and I would say one of the weaknesses of a certain amount of the literature has been that it's anticipated and exaggerated the extent to which a lot of British policy was in some way supposedly independent of France. or the theoretical French threat. I think you've got to be very careful there. On the other hand, it is certainly the case that there were opponents for British power in the subcontinent who were not aligned with France, and therefore when conflict arose with them, you can't really so readily argue that British anxieties about France forced those to the fore. You ask a question earlier, which is interesting, as to how continual conflict was. I think it's fair to say it varies by presidency, and it varies by scale. There is often, as it were, what you might call law and order issues. I think to the people involved, these might appear as the East India Company seeking to control their revenues or resources or outcomes to a degree they didn't want. So I think one's always got to look at that in a slightly more problematic fashion. But that didn't necessarily mean that there are full-scale operation. So if you're thinking, if you think of the 1790s, let's say 1780s, 1790s, peace with Mysore comes in 1784. There isn't another war with Mysore to the beginning of the 1790s. Peace there comes in 1792. There isn't another war with Mysore till the end of the 1790s, when indeed Tipu Sultan is killed in the storming and successful British storming of his capital, Seringapatam. War with the Maharathas is not continual, and to a certain extent, conflict between Maharatha rulers is as commonplace as conflict between the Maharathas and the British. And the major war is the one in the beginning of the 1800s, with famous battles at Assaye and Argam in 1803. There is no one end to that war, because there are several princes involved and they negotiate at different times. But you could fairly say that by the end of 1806, that war is over. And then there isn't a war against the Maharathas again until 1817. So I don't think you could say it was continual conflict, but I certainly think you could say it was frequent conflict. That, I think, would be right. Some of the biggest players in the area, the British never fought, or never fought at any significant fashion in this period. So, for example, the biggest conflicts in India, in the subcontinent of India in the 18th century, as I pointed out in my book on war in the 18th, or two books on war in the 18th century, are in fact Persian invasions of 1739 and Afghan invasions at the end of the 1750s, lasting up to 1761. Neither of those leads to war with the British. And indeed, from the perspective of modern subcontinental history, the argument that in some way Britain was a sort of the British challenge is the leading one, and maybe if you wish to add to that, Britain is in some way a pernicious imperial force, does rather downplay the extent to which there were other imperial or imperializing or expansionist, whatever term you want to use, powers in the area. Similarly, when the Chinese invade Nepal, Nepal appeals for support to the British Governor General, Cornwallis, the man that had been defeated at Yorktown in 1781. And Cornwallis, and indeed the East India Company as a whole, decide it would not be prudent to get involved. I think that was a very sensible view on their part. But it just again reminds us that, you know, depending upon how you define South Asia, and you could readily define Nepal as being part of it, the British fight a war with Nepal in the end of the Napoleonic period, with some hard-fought battles in 1815 in particular, you know, again, from that perspective, the narrative is not one simply of Britain being the key player.
Mm. What about the terms and conditions for British officers serving the East India Company? Were they similar terms to what they would have served in the regular British Army, and how were they recruited? Had they previously been in regular regiments and were encouraged to join the East India Company with better terms and conditions, or if the terms and conditions were better?
Oh, that's good. Yes, well, there's both an East India Company Army and, a point that tends to be neglected, an East India Company Navy as well. You shouldn't think of people necessarily being one or t'other in the sense of regulars or working for the East India Company. A classic thing to do was if you were put onto half pay, or indeed just completely demobilised at the end of a conflict in Britain, to seek opportunities elsewhere. Now, you could seek opportunities elsewhere in Europe, by which I mean in continental Europe. A certain number of people did that. And of course, there was a long tradition of Scots doing that. But you could also, as you correctly say, seek the available terms and conditions in India. So you've got a lot of people who have served in the regular military, who are, as it were, in difficulties, financial difficulties, particularly if they're younger sons, and many of them disproportionately are Scottish. And it represents a means of making money if you're successful, that is important, but also in the meantime of just being employed and paid and doing something. And I think it's fair to say that the East India Company forces have greater opportunities. They are very substantial forces, and young men, most famously, of course, or let's say most successfully, Robert Clive, can go far in them. In a sense, the situation changes when regular army units are increasingly present in India, because then their commanders tend to be placed in command of a joint force. So that, as it were, curtails the career possibilities for East India Company officers. But prior to that situation, I would say it was really quite a good opportunity. You may remember, if you're a reader of Jane Austen, that I think it's Colonel Brandon had, you know, he was still comparatively young, had been out and made his money in India. And Jane Austen, as in so much else, was reflecting the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like us to come to the 1850s and the Indian Mutiny. What caused the Indian Mutiny? Is it really just a matter of the particular grease used on cartridges? Or is there rather more to it than that?
Well, I think you're right. It is rather more to it than that. I mean, I've written a bit about it in a number of books, including my War in the 19th Century and my Military History of Britain. There are both flaws on the part, or shall we say, missteps on the part of British commanders, but also, as with earlier mutinies, there's never been a mutiny on that scale, but there are other earlier ones, for example, the one in 1806 at Vellore. There were what you might call more positive, or if you'd like to use a different term, more ideological or political reasons for opposition to Britain. The key thing that needs to be borne in mind, and that is because of this very misleading habit of calling it a war of independence or liberation or whatever, is that, not surprisingly, it was a civil war as far as the Indians were concerned. There were forces that rejected British control and fought against the British, and there were forces which took the exact opposite perspective and fought for the British and fought hard for the British. And again, this tends to be underplayed or presented in this rather silly idea of false consciousness. In other words, those people who were in some way understood what they should do, backed the mutiny, and those people who didn't back the British. That's crass. That is really crass as an interpretation of both of materialistic and of ideological reasons. But it was a serious, a really serious rising for Britain. There's no doubt at all about it. It was made less serious by the fact that, of course, it wasn't part, well, A, it wasn't arising by all of the Indian forces in the British Army, or even an overwhelming number of them. So that was number one importance. Number two importance, it wasn't seen more generally in the British Empire in Asia at the time. So let's say places like Ceylon, which was a separate crown colony, or the British territories already acquired in southern Burma, or Malaysia, modern-day Malaysia. Three, there wasn't a systemic crisis for the whole of the British Empire of that period. There weren't insurrections, you know, in, for example, the British colonies in Australia or New Zealand or Aden or whatever. Four, Britain was not at that point at war with another European power. The Crimean War, which we discussed last time, had ended. What that meant was, and Britain remained an ally of France, they in fact were shortly to cooperate in operations against China in the second so-called Opium War, or the Arrow War. Russia did not, although didn't mind seeing the British in difficulties in India, was not in a position to intervene. So in a sense, it was a contained crisis. If you wish to look for equivalents, you could look at the equivalents of the Maori Wars, where again, some of the Maoris were opposed to the British, some of the Maoris fought on the British side, although this is more problematic, considerably more problematic, because they were already separate states, but in geostrategic terms, they were isolated. The First Boer War of 1881 and the Second Boer War of 1899 to 1902. So it's not as serious a strategic threat as it might have been, but nevertheless, it causes alarm. And as you may know, I've shortly got a book coming out on Conan Doyle. And indeed in Jonathan Small, in providing his account about Sherlock Holmes about the Indian mutiny, presents it as a case of, you know, tiny numbers fighting vast, vast numbers of rebellious Indians who are extremely brutal. I think one could put some qualifications about both of those. There was brutality on both sides, extreme brutality on both sides. Also, the numbers were not, although initially extremely frightening in the upper Ganges Valley, were not on the Indian scale as disproportionate as might be suggested by that remark.
And should we think of the rebellion purely as a military mutiny, by which I mean some soldiers who are loyal to their officers fighting against some soldiers who rebel against their officers? Or was there a wider upswell, an armed upswell from Indian people beyond the ranks?
Well, there was a measure of the latter. Yep, there was a measure of the latter. There's no doubt about that. But again, I think one has to be careful about this. You know, it's only so much. I mean, for example, the Madras army didn't rebel, the Bombay army didn't rebel, about 30,000 men in the Bengal army didn't rebel, and the rulers of Hyderabad, Kashmir and Nepal, most prominently, though not not only them, and Hyderabad, Nizam of Hyderabad, extremely important ruler, they all provided military assistance to the British. So that, you know, in many of the battles in by 1858, the British were outnumbering their opponents, which, you know, I think is quite significant.
And when you say the British, are we also including law? We're including law sepoys in that.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes.
So do we have in very approximate numbers? Do we have a sense of roughly what proportion of sepoys remained loyal as opposed to those who rebelled? I mean, is it a majority on one side or the other?
The Bengal army, the British army in India in 1857 contained about 232,000 Indian and 45,000 British troops. The Bengal army is the largest portion of that. It comprised 135,000 Indian and 24,000 British troops. And of the Bengal army, about 30,000 remained loyal. So you'd be talking about roughly 105,000 sepoys rebelling and roughly 127,000 sepoys remaining loyal.
So there's a small but significant majority in favour of remaining loyal. And just out of interest, I mean, the role of animal fat being used in cartridges, which was a galvanising issue. I mean, was the truth in the allegation, or what is the evidence?
Well, I mean, the trigger is the demand that Indian soldiers used a new cartridge for the new patent 1853 Enfield rifle, a cartridge that was greased. That helps to keep the powder dry, particularly necessary in tropical climates, in animal fat, which was a measure unacceptable to, you know, to many, though obviously not all by any means, Muslims and Hindus for religious reasons. I think it's probable. Other factors were also important. Many Indians, for example, were unwilling to serve abroad for caste reasons, and the newfound determination of the British authorities to use India as, I mean, it had been used for these purposes earlier as against Mauritius or Egypt during the Napoleonic Wars. But the imperial authorities were very determined that Indian units should be deployed outside India, and that was not popular. But obviously the animal fat issue represented one that was easy to talk about, and I suspect was probably overplayed because it played into prejudices on both sides.
So the course of the mutiny, how did it start? Did the mutineers have clear leaders, or was it rather more an anarchic outpouring against their officers? And how was the tide turned?
Well, that's, again, a very interesting question. There was a measure of planning, but I think it's fair to say that, and this was true for both sides, the situation spun out of control in 1857 very rapidly in the Ganges Valley, without either side really being able successfully to control the flow of events, which is not surprising because they're interacting with each other and because both sides were uncertain as to the likely loyalty or likely results of particular clashes. The British army recovered fairly rapidly. It was helped by, as we've already discussed, the extent to which a lot of people didn't rise. It was also helped by the ability to move troops into the region, so from Singapore to Calcutta by boat, for example. And that was really quite important, that the Britain was an imperial power. It was able to move troops readily. And the British rapidly built up forces in northeast India and started what you might call counter-offensives, particularly towards Delhi, which after all was the symbol of imperial, not British imperial, but Mughal imperial power. So I would say that actually, compared to what could have happened, the initial stages were far less serious than, shall we say, the American War of Independence, where, as you will be aware, there were, you know, there was a near complete collapse of British authority in the 13 colonies. Well, it was a complete collapse by the end of March 1776. There was absolutely nothing like that in India. Once the major positions had been recovered in the Ganges Valley, there is quite extensive fighting in 1858, both there and in other parts of India, particularly in some of north central India. The British chase what they regard as rebels or insurgents. They find it difficult to master some of the forested areas, particularly in the northern Deccan. Although peace was officially declared by the Governor General on the 8th of July, 1858, the last battle was in May, 1859.
And after 1859, that was the end of the trouble, or were there further mini mutinies and threats of rebellions in the decades after that?
That's a good question. After 1859, the British were, on the whole, relatively, although they remained concerned and had an equivalent, the effect, you know, sort of political surveillance, the practicality was there was no real revolutionary tradition in the army thereafter, and the British found Indian units worthwhile and valuable supporters in places like China, Ethiopia, in the Second Afghan War, in moving to the Mediterranean during the crisis against Russia in 1878. And there was not any significant concern about loyalty. So I think it's reasonable. And of course, linked to that also, there were more British troops deployed in India itself. Mm-hmm. But I think it's fair to say that the attempt to draw that into some sort of revolutionary tradition, looking towards 20th century disaffection and eventually independence movements, I think is unconvincing.
Mm-hmm. So let's just go to the heart of that question of whether it was a war of liberation or war of independence. If it was a war of independence, as many Indian commentators now frame it, I mean, independence from what towards what?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I argued in my book, Imperial Legacies, that the concept of successive wars of independence is a way for Indians to emphasize their role in obtaining independence, as opposed to stressing a British willingness to cede control and earlier to seek to conciliate Indian concerns by granting a considerable degree of autonomy. Now, I mean, I think this tension over words and meanings is important for all historical narratives of decolonization. I think you've put it on, you know, very much, you put your finger on it. Exactly what do people imagine that there would have been had the British, as it were, been driven from India, or South Asia, I should say, at that juncture. And, you know, one's got to be very careful before arguing that there is some proto-Indian nationalism that might suit certain constituencies today, but I don't think it's a terribly terribly helpful approach to early and mid 19th century Indian history, still less to earlier Indian history.
Okay, so in essence, it's very unclear what would have emerged thereafter, but it wouldn't have been a unified Indian Republic.
Well, I don't see any particular evidence for that. You know, first of all, it would have been, if it had been more successful, a brutal civil war. It's a little difficult to see. Well, let's leave aside the question of how on earth they would have succeeded when they didn't manage to gain control of southern India, of Bombay, of Calcutta, of any port. You know, we'll leave all of these aside. Okay, the legitimacy factor that they were obviously looking for was Delhi as the old imperial Mughal capital. So one would think that one is talking about a sort of older, potentially Mughal revival. But again, you see, you've then got the issue of how do you address identities that are Islamic as well as Hindu. You know, you've got that problem, which is bound up in the issue to do with the Mughals. I'm just not quite sure where we're coming from. I think that what you're actually talking about is a post-independence attempt to write an exemplary so-called history that suits post-independence myths. And it's no accident that if you're looking at India, and again, this is not a criticism, this is the same thing could be found for other countries. If you're looking at India, you have, as it were, different and separate Congress Party and BJP myths about the past. They're irreconcilable, I think it's fair to say, which therefore means you've got to be very careful of talking about Indian accounts. There are very different accounts in India, let alone, as I've already mentioned at the outset, Pakistan and Bangladesh. And these things, I had an extensive passage in my Imperial Legacies about the cellular jail in the Andaman Islands, where the British developed it as a penal settlement. And if you look at I've been there, if you look at the way it's been, and you know, it's been discussed in film and all the rest of it, if you look at the way it's discussed there, it's actually in some respects quite misleading. So for example, there's discussion about the British imprisoning people guilty of the Lahore conspiracy case in 1915. Well, do you know, in most societies, if you murder judges, you don't generally do too well. And it's worth saying at the same time, many Indians as volunteers were fighting for Britain or for the British Empire, whatever you want to talk about it. And, you know, the sort of thing that they don't mention in the jail is the shock created for the prisoners by losing caste, by being sent to prison with other Indians who were of different castes. That's not part of the narrative. And I have to say, you know, all countries, you can find different, shall we say, narratives. Britain is the one that gets the most stick because it's the largest of the imperial powers of the 19th and early 20th century. But that does not mean that anti-British accounts are necessarily correct. I've just mentioned Lahore. I mean, it's worth pointing out that Lahore is now in Pakistan. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that many commentators who are currently Indian create a narrative about the history of British India which doesn't make much sense from a Pakistani perspective. Let's just put it like that. I mean, nor does it make much sense from the perspective of many Indians, nor does it make much sense from the perspective of an understanding of what the British were trying to do or of comparative empire in that period. But then on the other hand, it's political narratives that are at play. And one of, I think, the difficulties for people, if they look at history, is to you need to understand those narratives, both those narratives as they played out in the past, and also you need to be careful of assuming that a particular narrative that claims to be British or German, Australian, Pakistani or Indian is the totality of the narrative that could be offered. In the case of India, that happened for a while because Congress dominated the agenda for so long. But now that Congress has ceased to dominate the agenda, and actually, interestingly enough, a lot of the people who are most disgruntled about Britain are often people who had a nice ascendancy as part of the Congress system and are rather quite dissatisfied at the moment, though there are others that is not true of. One's got, you know, one's got to be careful about just taking that point of view.
Well, I'd like to end with a question to you about the consequences of the mutiny for the East India Company. It's wound up and the British Army takes over the military role. Was that inevitable given the financial strains the East India Company was on? Did the mutiny speed up the process or might the East India Company have steadied its own boat?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I mean, I think the military demand in South Asia grew in the 1840s and 50s for reasons which were not centrally related to the mutiny. I mean, the most difficult opponent, and this may offend some people, but I'm not trying to offend them, the most difficult defendant were not the mutineers. The most difficult defendant opponent faced by the British in that period were the Sikhs in the 1840s. Formidable soldiers, really difficult battles. And obviously, taking that further, the first Afghan war started off by not working out as the British had envisaged, which is being polite. Then there'd been the separate conquest of Sindh, sort of what we would call southern Pakistan. And of course, there's growing anxiety about Russia, and there's growing anxiety about Persia, Iran as well. And you're looking towards the second, and it's a difficult one, Anglo-Burmese war. So there's a whole host of factors there which push South Asia, the security concerns of South Asia to the fore. And the East India Company isn't designed for those. The East India Company is really not designed for that. And I think it's fair to say there'd been a tension within the East India Company from the late 18th century in particular, between the mercantile interests, and this is simplifying it, the mercantile interests who essentially wanted peace and a regular and reliable revenue stream, and shall we say proconsular officials, Calcutta, but not only in Calcutta, who were more interested in expansionism, but which cost a lot of money. Wellesley, for example, Wellington's older brother, was a financial disaster for the East India Company in the early 19th century, because the war with the Maharathas was, you know, really expensive. It was successful, but really expensive. So once you have to think of a very expensive security framework, then I think it's fair to say that the governance of India isn't fit for purpose in military terms. Now, the process of adjustment of that obviously varies, just as to use an analog, which is different. The process, you can argue that dominion status is the answer to what they called the white colonies. But at the same time, you could point out that the actual process of implementation of that is affected by a whole host of contingent factors. And I think that would be an important way to look at imperial history, that it's too easy to look at structural factors and to give them a independent and clear-cut causative power. Whether you are critical and want to put materialistic factors, as in Marxist accounts, or ideological factors, as in people who argue that in some way they were racist. You know, you can put those to the fore, or you could put, as it were, so-called realist accounts to the fore, as in geostrategic issues. You can do all sorts of things. You could vary those, you could meld those, but however you do it, you have to see that there were contingencies, and you have to be very cautious about assuming that one contingency necessarily is the only one at play. So I agree with you that the mutiny is important. I agree with you. But I think it is also important to note the other factors. And I'd like to close in my military history. You know, I always like to look at original sources at the same time that obviously I write on the bigger picture. And I was reading a set of letters from a lieutenant in the 84th Foot writing from Kampur, which was a real centre of bitter fighting during the mutiny. And he's writing to his parents. And he says a whole host of things, but one of the things he says is he notes that the rebels did not dare, quote, charge our little squares with their clouds of cavalry. Now, that presents a description which apparently paints a clear picture of the superiority of Western fighting methods, okay? And, you know, you'll find all sorts of people who will just quote one source to suit them. But then you need to go on and read the rest of the letter. He continued, they had most magnificent gunners. In other words, artillerymen. And obviously, to quote one rather than the other would be, to put it mildly, not very helpful. And I think one of the difficulties with a lot of the writing on empire is a lot of it has been flattened. By flattened, what I mean is a lot of the writing has sought to take one particular approach. Pearson, incidentally, I mean, he was writing that in July 1857. He noted the following month and, you know, the difficult nature of the fighting. He wrote that the British forces had taken very heavy casualties, adding, quote, this quote I'm giving you is in bits. Village fighting, desperate. We took two sepoy prisoners the other day and they were blown away from the guns. The stink of fresh flesh was sickening in the extreme, but I have seen so many disgusting sights and so much bloodshed that I have grown quite callous. Now, I mean, that's Pearson writing to his parents. I think a very accurate account of the brutality seen, as I underlined, on both sides during the war. The mutineers' treatment of civilians helps to inflame British regulars, and British regulars then kill rebels and indeed some Indian civilians. The whole thing spins horribly out of control. It is an unattractive episode. It is an instance of what is so often the case that is necessary to realize, that insurgency warfare, like its counterinsurgency response, inherently, particularly in the context of a civil war, and if you want to call the Indian mutiny something other than the mutiny, you can call it an Indian civil war. There were many other Indian civil wars, of course, but I don't think the Indian nationalist commentators would like that. But these kind of conflicts tend to be particularly unpleasant, and it doesn't help if, with the perspective so-called of history, people underplay that horror because they like or dislike a particular outcome. Whether in this case the outcome was as it was to be, the reimposition of British control, or whether it would have been some further overthrow of that control. Again, you can take different viewpoints on how desirable it was, how undesirable it was, whether it occurred at the right terms or other. You can take all sorts of views on it. The indubitable fact about it was at least 1.5 million civilians got murdered during it. And people need to think a bit more seriously about those sort of figures and about the extent to which Independence, so-called, because obviously independence for some is not always independence for all. Independence was often a brutal process. And when one thinks about it going on in the world today as well, you can see exactly the same issues and problems.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.